hey, if that thing didn't have a password at all, and it was just like an AV control system, we never would have batted an eye. Like, you know, we have controls outside conference rooms all the time. No password on that. Put a password on and everybody starts mocking how simple it is. I would argue maybe this video surveillance system shouldn't have had a password. And if it didn't, it would have never even made the audit report.
The Adversarial Podcast. Why you gotta be so adversarial? It's time to get adversarial.
Hey guys, welcome back to the Adversarial Podcast. Welcome to November 2025. We've got a packed agenda of some fun stuff here and our usual projection of micro themes into macro themes. Sunil and Mario, good to see you guys. Looks like you're both at home base for a little bit. Yeah? Is that true, yep. Mario?
We are.
Next time I'll be somewhere else. I think I'll be either Canada or Saudi Arabia, or one of those two places.
Yeah, I always mix those up. You know, it's like pretty much a roll of the dice for me.
One has a lot of water, the other one doesn't. I'll make sure I get the right one.
Yeah, yeah. Actually, the one thing they do have in common is that they're kind of converging on their foreign relations status with the United States.
Yes.
I like to think that wherever country Sunil's visiting is getting smarter about security or wants to lean in security. So that's my, Canada really wants to lean in security. Sunil's visiting there.
Yeah, so definitely update us on which one you go to so we can invest accordingly.
Yes, exactly.
Well, good. So jumping right in, we have a cool little list of topics here curated by our intrepid producer, Tilson. Thank you. Kicking off. So like, look, the Louvre heist, it's not a cyber thing at all. So let's be 100% clear about that. I'm still sure there will be a headline saying now that we've said it was a cyber heist. But in any event, the world followed it because, frankly, it's kind of a movie theme, right? It's kind of fun and the classic jewel heist and all of that. But the most recent reports kind of dumped on them saying that someone got a hold of a 2014 audit report and there were things in there that looked damning from a cyber perspective. In particular, it said the password for the Louvre video surveillance system was Louvre. And if you'd read into that, it also said a similar password on a Talos system was Talos and that sort of thing. I had some pretty strong reactions to that. What did you guys have any reactions to that first?
2014, at least it wasn't the default password. So, you know, they got that for going for them.
Or is it?
Wait, yeah. The report was 2014?
Well, I mean, Talos being the default password for a Talos system was probably a default. But obviously the video surveillance system, the default won't be Louvre.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, so when I looked at this, it reminded me of a situation where someone had a 4-digit PIN on an iPad and everybody laughed about it. And I was like, hey, if that thing didn't have a password at all and it was just like an AV control system, we never would have batted an eye. Like, you know, we have controls outside conference rooms all the time. No password on that. Put a password on and everybody starts mocking how simple it is. I would argue maybe this video surveillance system shouldn't have had a password. And if it didn't, it would have never even made the audit report. What if it's air-gapped and manned by armed guards?
There was a case a little while ago around drone footage, UAV footage, that the Army didn't encrypt and anyone could just listen into. And there was an argument made, a pretty legitimate argument made from an operational context that, it didn't need to be. A password didn't need to be there on there, and it didn't need to be encrypted because we could have potentially caused other operational issues. Now they may have eventually encrypted it, who knows? But there were legitimate operational reasons for this for why it was the way it was. Could anyone have listened in, including the people who were about to get struck? I suppose sure. At the point that they could see it, they would probably not be there very long afterwards. But anyway, the point is that not everything has to be encrypted. Not everything has to have a password. If that's your point, I would agree. I don't have the specific circumstances around where the system was. But again, 2014, I remember, part of the reason why we passed like the Patch Act in the U.S. is because we found too many things that had default passwords set. And so part of the act was to say, hey, make sure at least if you have a default password, that it's not the same default password across every system out there.
Huh. Yeah. And, you know, when I looked at this, though, I called this bit site syndrome, which is to say,
totally.
From an outside perspective, you pick at the stuff that you can see. And, you know, like I say bit site because they would scan and like they overemphasize TLS certificate support and things like that, which is just petty, completely immaterial in real life for security. It doesn't contribute to actual incidents and so on. And yet it became like 50% of auditors' preoccupation because there's companies that could scan for it. And I felt like that's the same thing that was going on in here. The other things were Windows 2000, right, being old.
Yep.
And like I always lecture in class and I say like Windows 2000, or I use XP or 98 or whatever, isn't a risk. Like Windows 2000, therefore having known vulnerabilities that don't have patches and are in a situation where they're exploitable, is totally a risk, right? But it's not because it's Windows 2000. It might be a contributing factor, but you can't just like, you need a complete sentence, right? So what's the TTP here? If you're threat modeling for the Louvre and physical security, I want to see threat intel about breaks, break and enter and robberies. And I want to see someone brute forcing their way into a video surveillance system on the local keyboard as part of that. And then I'm going to put it in my risk register and burn this one down. But to just pick it out of the air, I don't think it has any correlation at all with the fact that someone was able to break in with a ladder truck.
So I thought about, I was the first thing I said when I read this report about this video surveillance camera with an easy password. I forget what the password was. Was it password? But I thought, oh, wow, this is Ocean 6-7. Joking.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. I'm showing my millennial wannabe.
yeah, exactly.
Or maybe Z. Anyway, so I was trying to figure out, well, wow, there's a connection between this. Maybe they compromised the video surveillance camera and they were able to get in, but none of that was on the report. So outside of any connection of that, this is what I think what we're all echoing here or saying is, you know, it's this whole compliance world where they look at these problems or deficiencies that have nothing to do with the systems they're testing or the environments they're testing. And it just bothers me. What does that have to do, this surveillance or Windows 2000, have to do with the security, the physical security of the Louvre? I don't know. There's something missing. It's really, folks, and again, just like on the bit side, I'm sorry, I'm going to poop on bit site. But it's like saying, huh, by the way, I'm a horrible cook. I cannot make an egg for my life. I can't even freaking boil the damn thing. I'm being serious. But does that translate to me being a poor guitar player? What does that have to do with anything? And so I'm missing the connection.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. We talk to our kids about that all the time about... my wife was just lecturing our son this morning and saying, like, when you name call on someone with whom you disagree fundamentally, you lose the entire audience. Like, when you pick at something that's not relevant here, then everybody just tunes you out. So, you know, articulate your viewpoint.
Ad hominem.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yes.
So.
Policies of argument.
yeah. That's another episode in itself.
Yeah.
Another thing, you know, there was a story that came out that was, it was CNBC, right? And it was talking about, it led with Trump, with the word Trump. That's a good way to get a lot of clicks and likes. Trump budget cuts, agency gutting, leave Americans at greater risk of being hacked. And then it went on to iterate through like a litany of specific things where funding is kind of being withdrawn. I shouldn't say kind. It was being absolutely withdrawn. In some cases, things are being cut. And in other cases, it's being second-guessed or questioned. And you know, make connections between that and cybersecurity posture of either national defense or even the private sector and so on. So, I looked through this a little bit and have some reactions, but how do you guys feel about this? Are we in danger here?
All right. So I think the first question I ask is, the budget that was being used, how did it actually help us, lower risk, if any, in any particular way? The government is here to help, but having been in private sector where government wasn't really that much of a help. You know, where is it actually helping? And maybe that's the first question. I think the answer, one answer is you have a lot of organizations that don't have that. You know, there's large organizations and there's a whole bunch of small ones, and I don't have direct exposure into what the small organizations got from the government in terms of security benefits and such, cybersecurity benefits and such. But one area that I have heard is as it pertains to information sharing with the MSISACs and whatever else it is. But that begs the question of the threat intelligence coming from those ISACs, were they ever really useful? Was it a rehash of stuff that we already knew? I don't live in that small, medium-sized business space, or, you know, the multi-state type of space. So I can't say what if there was much value there, but I do get the sense that some organizations that were depending upon that or use that, leverage the free services and now have to pay for it from private sector, that they're not too happy about it. But I would say if it was of value, then go get the private services. Go buy it from a vendor, because that's probably where the threat intelligence came from anyway.
Yeah, I don't know. In my time, you know, working at that intersection, I'll say, like, I don't know. There's this impasse between operators and kind of public policy people when it comes to the value of intelligence, in particular tactical intelligence. And there's this romantic notion that the government is monitoring, you know, internal communications of adversaries and figuring out what they're going to do next and somehow operationalizing that in a way that the private sector ingests it and then is ahead of the threat and blocks it before it happens. Complete fantasy, like never has happened. I'm not sure if it could even happen, but even if it could, burning the channels, so to speak, would obviate that. It's not going to happen. And on top of that, we never consumed a feed really of anything, even private, but certainly from the public sector, of things that enabled us to do real-time blocking. The intel we got out of government sources was generally, you know, after the fact and kind of thematic, and they were really good at state-sponsored actors that had like a national security threat. You would hope so, right? But they weren't delivering anything that was going to help people not even get ransomware, no less, you know, crypto mining and just like the commodity day-to-day threats. I didn't see much of that. So I don't think that's in danger of getting abated through budget cuts.
Well, to me, that begs the question. That begs the question. What is it? I mean, trust me, I'm, you know, we're all cybersecurity people. So of course we want to lower the risk of being hacked. And if there's something that we can spend out of our taxpayer dollars to do that, I'm all for it. What I don't have a clear view of, and this is not, you know, to be political in any stretch or imagination here. It's just, what are the things that actually have moved the needle, going back to one of the themes that we've talked about, that the government can actually have influence here? And if we can find what those are and fund those things, then I think we'll be spending our money more.
I like that.
You know, I read CNBC on a regular basis. I like to see how my portfolios are doing. So that's just the thing, first thing I do in the morning. When I see articles like these, and I don't know, I'm not going to say any necessarily negative about Ms. McBride, the author of this article, but I just feel like, okay, let's go find something to click on and get somebody's attentions, because, you know, well, the government's shut for over 38 days. Let's just pile more. Let's just go pile these budget cuts and the whole thing, the government being shut. Maybe we'll add this story to just get more people's attentions. I couldn't make sense of it personally, and I didn't think it was very useful when I read it. So sorry to be so critical, Ms. McBride, the author, but it wasn't very useful to me. And I don't know what executives, if any executives read this CNBC article, what would they ask? What would they even think about it?
Well, there was one mention in their article that I thought was worth at least having a further conversation around. And the specific quote in the article was that there was a concern that a rule that made big tech companies responsible for developing safer software has been stripped of its enforcement mechanism. Now, we're not sure exactly which rule this was. As far as I know, there wasn't. There's no rule that I know of that was specifically being put up for discussion. But it might be just because ignorance here. So if someone does know, you know, love to see the rule,
please.
But there was a provision in the National Cyber Strategy for to start the discussion of software liability. And the fact that it was included in the national strategy, I thought, was meaningful because it put at least the conversation up for discussion, right, at a much broader level. So it moved it into the Overton window of being acceptable for discussion. I didn't think that there'd be anything meaningful coming out of it immediately because it is such a thorny question and issue. But the fact that we're at least talking about it and starting to have the executive agencies look into what it takes to have an enforcement mechanism is what I thought was meaningfully useful here. Whether there would actually come out an actual, I mean, the rule would have been shot down. People would have said, no, there's no way to actually enforce this or to make this work. That's fine. But at least the conversation would have begun and we would start to move the needle towards understanding what are the limits of software liability. And I think this is going to be even more interesting, especially as more and more software is developed by AI systems. And we don't really have great accountability in terms of how that, I mean, like, yeah, ultimately, it's the company's responsibility and the developer's responsibility for whatever AI generated code is pushed into production, so to speak. But there's just going to be so much more code. And then the question of liability of that code is going to become even more pertinent as we have more of it, more and more of it.
I think I'm just going back to the, I think we're trying to make more, given more oomph to this article than what it really is. You know, we're trying to figure out, we're trying to read between the tea leaves. What the heck is this thing? And honestly, the conspirator looks at this and says, oh, it's a Friday morning. You know, what am I doing? I'm probably stuck on a flight and can't fly because, you know, there's not enough folks working in the airport to keep us safe. And I open this up and it's just going to make me even angrier. And then I want to see who, when I click on it, who's the advertiser for that, what the banners pop, right? And say, oh, is this a security company? This is what's going on. They're trying to sell me something. Of course they're selling you something.
Well, I mean, I will tell you, if anybody knows what this rule was that they were talking about, it'd be good to hear about it. But like, Sunil, what you're talking about is... We've both been, you more much more than me, but we've both been involved in some public policy influencing groups over the time, like, you know, Physic itself. I was interviewed by the Cyber Solarium Commission at some point during that whole process. And like what you described, I remember that always being mentioned in the same breath as Underwriter Labs. Right? People would always say, like, that's an example of something that was successful, and maybe we need to apply the same concept to software. And I think in general, like the market economics of it say, software hasn't had as much implications for immediate danger as electricity yet. And therefore, it's better to stay off and let it run a little bit and let the pace of innovation stay really high. Because once we get to the point where the next SEMGREP or, you know, whatever innovative startup it is that comes out tomorrow, when they have to hit a wall of regulation and licensing before they can go live and spend 18 months with lawyers, it's just really going to stifle innovation. And I agree with that. So I'm glad the pace we're going, as sad as it is, I mean, this is what happened with electricity. It's what happened with vehicles and safety belt regulation, all of that. There was going to have to be not just one, but maybe a few things that the pace of software coming out is really causing kinetic damage over and over again to where the brakes are really put on. And for better or worse, I mean, I'm a big fan of Intel-based protections. Like, I don't think most companies should be trying to prevent being patient zero. Like, you don't need to protect against conceptual threats. You can afford to read the Intel and wait till your peers all get hit and then protect yourself against what they, you know, learn from others' mistakes. And so I think that's in the right place here. And so when it said, like, again, we all don't know where that came from. So if anybody at CNBC wants to, you know, track that down. And it was really unusual for a professional journalist, and this is a professional journalist, to mention that and then the next paragraph not to explain, like, what she was talking about. It almost seems like it accidentally got cut and they made a mistake there.
She quoted, she said, security experts mentioned that blah, blah, blah. I think
yeah, exactly.
She did.
Where are the experts?
Right?
Who
like
are they?
It's like the Day Brothers. They said this. I always want to find out who
the Day Brothers
are.
Yeah.
They're everywhere.
I think it's almost like an editing mistake.
You know, 9 out of 10 dentists. I want to find out that one dentist who didn't choose that
one. You know who it is. Yeah. You know it's me. But, yeah. But I mean, the general idea of... Look, I mean, it all goes back to secure by design and SBOM to an extent. And like, if you're going to offer software to the public, you need to follow these standards and be transparent and it's weighing that against innovation. So we'll keep an eye on that. But if there were a bill out there saying that people can't make software unless it's safer and what that implied was regulation and paperwork and barriers, I mean, on balance, I think I wouldn't have been very excited about it. So I'm not losing too much sleep if there was something like that that got nixed. All right. Let's talk about AI. We're like deep into the episode and we haven't talked about it enough yet. A series of articles have been coming out about the threats posed by AI and AI-enabled malware. And what I like is some people in my universe have taken some issue with that because we are all in the security industry up against vendor-magnified threat intelligence. Like when all you sell is a hammer, then you want to call everything a nail. And so there was some analysis done from a number of articles that have come out recently. And someone in particular was starting to take issue on Blue Sky and like to paste out some actual refutations of a number of pieces that were published. Google, however, came out with their report just last week where they analyzed using their omniscient ability to read all prompts in Gemini, which is always weird to me. They're like, no, we don't touch your data. We won't ever see what you're doing. And then anytime something goes on, they're like, we busted them because we read all the prompts. Like,
yes.
How can you do both?
I think the report here is very indicative of how much direct oversight or direct visibility they have into all the prompts that are issued.
Wait a minute. I'm shocked. You're telling me they're looking at our data? Really?
Well,
stop it.
Not that just that they're looking at it. Obviously, there is some AI
We're
system
joking.
Looking at it. Yeah. But the level of like, you think a lot of these things may just fly under the radar, but it doesn't, right? There's a lot of intelligence being put on top of this, of every interaction that's happening with Google that... in some cases they're used for good and in some cases used for profit. In other cases, who knows, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I encourage people to look at the Google AI threat tracker report. Because if you read the whole thing, it's great. It's objective. If you try to summarize it and take the sensational headlines, then you'll probably be misinformed. But among other things, and this just tells you about like the access they have. They're basically saying, hey, we're seeing scammers using our platform to generate social engineering pretext, which is no surprise, right? I mean, I'm getting people using it to sell me crap nonstop all day. So no surprise. But it means that they're reading it. And it mentions even being involved in busting some people because they're able to read their prompts and onward. But ultimately, when they go through actual malware that, when someone asked me about it, I said, like, look, malware and so many other things in life are defined by what they do and not by what they are. And so, if there's code running on your machine and it wants to employ an LLM for something akin to polymorphism, right, for like probabilistic manifestation, if you will, every time it runs, it looks different to try to evade capture. For it to do that, the software doesn't bring its own LLM, right? It's usually some kind of connection to the equivalent of an API. So you kind of get into the, is it okay for software in your environment to just reach out at random to APIs and transfer data back and forth all day? And that was probably an issue long before AI-enabled malware anyway. But then also when it comes to like ransomware, the problem isn't the queries and the prompts. The problem is encrypting all the files on the system, right? So if things are still monitoring for behavior, and noticing when there's a pattern of destroying data, then it doesn't matter whether AI is involved in that or not, right? And even in this report, the examples that are in here were very theoretical and or busted by existing controls already.
Yeah. Well, so I'm going to say this without hopefully giving too many ideas to those on the other side, so to speak. But I think these what we're seeing are amateur uses of this technology. What I would say is really more interesting is if you consider the notion of living off the land, attackers live off the land because they don't have to bring their tools with them, right? They can leverage all the wonderful tools that Microsoft already offers to break into everything. But once we know, once an attacker knows that you have an AI system available to you that can do some basic, let's say, mining of data or results without ever having to move it from off of that environment to someplace else, okay, or if it's following standard paths that are already sanctioned, then it opens up opportunities to do, for example, I don't have to move content off to search through it. I can just search through it there. Okay, I can throw my own sort of intelligence on top of that environment and winnow through a lot more things quickly just because I have an AI agent or assistant next to me living off the land already.
Yeah.
I would absolutely not use AI to do an actual attack because you have to have very deterministic outcomes, right?
Probabilistic doesn't work? Probabilistic systems don't work? What?
I mean, the worst thing about exploit development is you have like 45 different variants of windows and you don't know which one's going to work and which ones are not going to work, right? Yeah. And so just now imagine doing that for an AI-generated ransomware. It's like, no, that's just stupid. You're not going to want to have to deal with some additional level of randomness there. The amateur approach of like, let me just have an AI system code malware for me or ransomware for me. I think, you know, they'll get past that really quickly. What I think is going to be more interesting is when they really truly leverage it the way we internally would use it to say, I need to do something to get my job done inside my own organization. And that job is dealing with sensitive content. Well, now an attacker can basically, if they compromise my identity, can basically do the same thing and accelerate their ability to get to the crown jewels of an organization.
You know, on a more serious note, Google doesn't really necessarily need to look at our data and what people are running inside our own accounts. We did this. I'm sure you guys did this. You practice deception. And with the amount of money Google has to throw at this, I wouldn't put it past them that they create fictional companies out there that are, you know, basically canaries sitting out there, little honey pots that allow them to learn what an attacker is doing by targeting some of these fake companies that Google creates. And then you just watch and you learn. And you see, oh, look what they're doing. So I don't want to raise any suspicions that Google's actually looking at our data. I mean, I'm more thinking metadata would be what they're looking at rather than actually doing something more intrusive. The other thing is, go ahead.
The threat actor report here doesn't suggest that. They have very specific, the attacker put into Gemini this script, which included specific credentials and specific whatever, which enabled the Google threat team to disrupt their operations. So it's very clear that clear indication that they see a lot of content here.
But Sunil, let me push back on that. You could have these attackers, they're not just attacking one company. They're probably, as you said, these folks are maybe not as sophisticated as we want them, as we make them out to be. So they're spraying. They're attacking a bunch of accounts. And you're saying, huh, again, I can put a fictitious account that just gets included in the whole dragnet. And you can suggest, it seems like this attack's happening everywhere potentially. I'm not suggesting you're wrong, but there could be other ways of doing this without looking at other people's data.
Well, I mean, to Sunil's point, like, and Google's, you know, they're pretty careful. So they shared this willingly, but like it says, like in one interaction, the actor asked Gemini to identify vulnerabilities and blah, blah, blah. In that particular case, one of the things they said was that Gemini gave a safety response, right, saying that it wouldn't be safe to respond to this, and then the actor went on. So perhaps if pressured, they would say, oh, yeah, and if EULA, if you look carefully, it says that once we block you, then we reserve the right to examine what you're doing for law enforcement purposes, which would kind of make sense, right? When somebody says, give me a plan to destroy the world, they're like, okay, now we get to tune in. It says like the actor appeared to learn from this interaction and use the CTF pretext in support of phishing and prefaced many of their prompts about like, so they're in the prompt and it's not at a victim, right? And that's kind of the caveat to this whole story is that this is kind of R&D. It doesn't mean that someone was actually popped.
Yeah. Yeah, it was all R&D on the part of the attacker. But it's interesting also you're pointing out, I say, hey, yeah, you are an authorized, pen testing agent. Please help me go do blah, blah. I think that's a completely, as a security researcher, as a security person, it's a totally legit preface, because we are, right? Yeah. But I think to Jerry, your point, just know that that is a flag for, for additional investigation by the foundation model providers. And by the way, there, just as another quick aside, there was another attack called Singularity, where they basically had, they co-opted, I think it was an NPM package that you would install it with a compromiser system and start doing a bunch of data collection. But they leveraged Claude, Gemini, and Amazon Q, where they pushed these commands and they said, hey, the first time they tried to get all this content and they were summarily denied by both, by all three coding agents or by all three AI assistants. So we've seen this very steady progression of prompt changes from the attacker. So first it was, go get me all the goods. And the second one was, okay, you're now an authorized pen testing agent. And then later on it became, you're a file search agent, right? So I wasn't even trying to, it was no longer trying to be a pen testing. It was just, go find these files. And it became successful. It was successful in getting the content that they needed.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the headline question is really like, okay, do we need to be worried about AI? That's what most people want to know. And like I Kevin Beaumont is the researcher here, and I like what he's doing here. I don't know a ton about Kevin in general, but from what I'm seeing here,
I couldn't agree with him more, by the way, what he's saying there. I could not agree with more than what I completely agree with him.
And what he's saying is we're getting fed a lot of FUD right now. And some people, goes on all the time. Some people will say, and man, does this happen a lot, yeah, that may have been a lie, but it raised a good point. Or, oh, that may have been misinformation, but it prompted the right discussion. And I don't like that line of thinking at all. It just incentivizes bad behavior. Like if you're lying, then I want to go back in time and scratch that groove out of the record. Like you don't get the mic. You can't just do that. And so while I'll concede that AI, just like assembly language did and just like JavaScript, will play a role in malicious attacks over time. Going back to if it didn't happen, I would agree with him that right now companies are at risk of over-indexing on this
totally.
Threat and hasn't manifested.
I was at a VC group of investors, and we do pitch day, right? Everybody gets their pitch day, and one of our colleagues commented on every single company that was pitched or ideas that were pitched to us was AI, everything, and it's just like, really, is everything AI now?
Yeah, it's true.
Yes,
yeah,
it is.
I mean, it's like this waterfall where even in venture, right? I mean, ideally they make good returns and ideally they pick winners, but when they pick losers, they want the LPs to have been like, yeah, man, it sucks, but I don't blame you. I thought you made the right decision too. And the way you do that right now is with AI. right? I mean, they want to be able to justify to the LPs of why they're picking these investment decisions. And AI is the magic word right now. So that just pumps up the value even to them because they can even afford to fail a little more now.
It's definitely frothy. I think, though, it's just to go back to Kevin's comments. And by the way, Kevin Beaumont is really famous, in my view, in the cloud world. So he goes by Gossy the Dog. I love his posts because it's always a bunch of snark. But he does point out, like, the Google threat report itself is solid. It's just how media reports on it,
correct?
Right?
Exactly.
There's that issue. Okay, so how media spins it for the clicks is one thing, but he does also point out in his prior threads that even sometimes you do have to question the actual research itself. And the one that he lambasts is the MIT one, where there was a MIT ransomware, AI-driven ransomware study, and he basically questioned it with the authors, and eventually MIT took it down. Okay.
Yeah.
Mm. Okay. So that's a whole different level of shadiness. I think Google's report is pretty solid. It's just how it was characterized by the media that makes it overblown.
Yeah, and kudos to him because before he heroically gunned down that MIT piece, and we're calling it an MIT piece. I mean, and schools need to be careful because when they put their name on stuff, people like us call it the MIT piece, and no one's reading the footnotes about, well, technically it was, I don't even know what their excuse is. But what it had said was 80% of ransomware attacks employed AI, and the damage is done when a headline like that flies. And when you stamp the MIT brand on it on top of that, people are done and off getting off the plane and making decisions based on that kind of thing. And it turned out to not only be just falsified, but to be sponsored by a vendor who stood to benefit from this sensationalism as well.
And brings, not to bring back our previous discussion, but there's a CNBC article. What is this all about? Why are we even talking about this on CNBC?
Media makes money by clicks.
So another report that came along out of Nevada was really interesting. So this was a write-up about an incident that they experienced this year in 2025. But for some context on that, like, I've been doing something in class called that I call a tabletop red team exercise. And what I basically say is, and going back to threat intel, that you want to learn from others' mistakes. And ideally, you spend $120,000 and with a professional red team organization, and they come through for 8 weeks. And at the end, you see where you would have fallen flat, and that's what you fix. But you could kind of shortcut that by taking somebody else's incident and then just sitting in a room with the right smart people and saying, would this have worked here? Oh, crap, put it in the risk register. Would this work? No? Okay, good. And, you know, it's kind of the poor man's version. So I have students do that and come up with a org that they're pretending to assess and then a report and do it. So this is the type of report that I'll direct them to use because it walks through the TTPs of an actual incident. And in this case, it was the state of Nevada who had about 28 days of outage, and they published this report just recently, and I think it's great, a lot of detail here, and they go on to say how they didn't pay the ransom, and instead they spent shy of $1.5 million, and more or less says that it is a good spend. Mario, I see you champing at the bit here. Did you have some immediate reactions to the report?
Okay, so besides the Nevada thing, I just want to give unfair kudos to my colleague, Jerry. That class that he's talking about, that is actually pretty impressive that students are able to get that kind of education. You know, that whole red top, red team.
Red top, I like that.
Red team tabletop. Scenario is gold. I mean, we do that in corporate America or wherever you do, and they do, depending on who the company is, they do provide a lot of good learning things. So kudos to you, Jerry, for running that program.
Well, thank you.
So, you know. On this Nevada thing, I also want to give kudos to Nevada for, like, well, you didn't pay the ransomware. It cost you $1.5 million. How much do you think that ransomware guy was asking for how much money they were asking for that particular attack? And as you find, I mean, the thing that was, so anyway, I think that would be my highlight on that.
So I, when I went through the report, I made some notes, and they're going to seem like they're a little bit disjoint, but you go through one of these things and it just brings up all these important things. One of the early mentions they have in the report, and this is so classic PR, and by the way, it reads like FTI or Brunswick wrote it. Yeah, there is credit. I forget who wrote it, but it's not a traditional comms company. But it reads so well. And in it, of course, it says that they had Mandiant come in and do an investigation. And they call it a privileged forensic investigation, right? Which is their keyword of saying, don't even ask for it because it's protected by privilege. So one of the things that would be right down the middle for this show is about the assertion of privilege in the cyber context. And the way it's always worked is that law firms say, before you spend $250,000 with Mandiant, don't forget to also spend $250,000 with us, because as long as you route emails through us, then nobody can ever read anything that was written. And right, privilege is about legal advice. And so it's a bit of a strain there, because they're trying to say the entire commissioning of Mandiant and all of the reports were actually part of a legal opinion we were giving you. And that doesn't always hold, right?
Okay, so here's something I think I find somewhat remarkable. And if there are other cases, I would love to see more of these cases. But the fact that this is a public report, okay? Let's consider that for a moment. It's a public report. Mm-hmm. So what exactly fell under privilege here? Okay. The perspective that it's a public report suggests a couple other things as well. When you have a security incident, usually you don't publicize that, okay? If you have a safety incident, here is everything for everyone to know so that you can avoid this sort of safety failure in the future. Everyone should be aware because it's a safety issue, right? But a security issue, law enforcement gets involved, lawyers get involved, all these sort of things. And a lot of the things that we might potentially learn from it don't get the light of day. So what I think is remarkable about this report is, one, it's public. The fact that it's public is noteworthy in itself. And I'm sure there are other ransomware reports as such that may be public too. But this coming from, a fairly large organization, state of Nevada, and making it public, despite the fact that some words in there suggest that there was privilege around it, I think it's pretty cool. I wish we saw more of this, because to me, this is more a safety issue now and not a security issue.
Yeah. Can I ask you a question? Now that you're making the safety issues interesting, because there was some sex offender database that was offline for 3 weeks is what they said as well in the report. So now I'm making the safety connection. So now right. That's real world, right? But can I rewind and talk a little bit about hiring PR companies? It has been my experience that you do want to hire a PR experienced company that has gone through or helped customers with cyber attacks. And so I think they're really, in my opinion, worth engaging their services. You want to prepare, you want to work with them, and you want to have some preparations for the event that something might happen, often happens, and test that muscle.
Yeah, it's weird. As you read through this, and to your point, as you read through this report, it's like a tale of two cities, right?
Yeah.
On one hand, you can read through this, and God forbid I go back to the Louvre again and just like throw stones because of the things, but you can see shortcomings in the control posture environment all throughout the thing. And I hope companies who tabletop exercise it do it like that. So for example, an employee downloaded a backdoored fake tool. They were like, oh, I got to run whatever it was, Windows NT Resource Kit or whatever it was. They Googled for it. Some crap SEO, because that's what most SEO is like crap. And so they directed them to the wrong download. They downloaded it. It was really Trojaned. They executed it, right? So many bad things there, right? I mean, I haven't gotten the URL yet, but I bet it was a .top domain. So the TLD blocking could have saved them, I bet. Who knows? But then once they download something, EDR wasn't there and didn't kill it. Somehow Symantec quarantined it a month later. And they document that, but they don't really highlight what that gap was. It was able to do some kind of call outs as well. The employee self-installs admin tools as root. There's another thing, local administrator administrative rights. That was a shortcoming. And this is an old school NT environment, so that matters.
The Windows shop, if I check.
Windows shop.
Remember.
Yeah. They did lateral movement with, they capture credentials. So I'm sure, you know, that word always means not really sure, but I feel confident, having seen this playbook a million times, that they probably dumped LSAS and saw the local credentials of people who had logged in, and that include administrators. So why are admins logging on there? They installed Lapse later as a mitigating strategy. So clearly they didn't have randomized local administrator accounts. So you could read through this and come up with a billion things that they failed to do. Yet at the same time, you could look at the incident response. And by the way, they said that they exercised the incident response playbook, and like that was the thing. There's no such thing as a playbook. The playbook probably said, get these people together on the bridge and way to go. That's a W. Yeah. That's the playbook, and you did it and you won. And someone was in charge, and that's the win here. And there was decisiveness, and they did call Mandiant quick, and they did engage their insurance broker because they already had a policy. So it almost seems like really good leadership that was working with a really bad budget. And now they're like, I've been telling you we got to do this. Now we're going to get it done. Right. So I don't know. I mean, I look at it, I can see things to do, but it tells you that leadership can make up for a pretty good bit just in the response. And they knew what to deploy the minute that they got the win in their sales from this.
But I think it was focusing, like you were talking about the playbook, focusing on the areas that you know you can control. Try to focus on those things. Like, who do you call when this stuff happens? How many people do you have a bridge set up? Is it a Slack? Is it a Zoom? Whatever that is. I mean, I don't want to overstate that, but I think that's still helpful. I think when there's a drama going on, when there's an emergency, you don't want to be thinking about who you need to dial and how to dial. Okay, so let's not. To me, that was kudos to them.
Yeah, but I'll tell you, I encourage everyone to go through this report, and in particular near the end. And this is just really pro. They articulated their kind of PR. I wouldn't quite say strategy, but their PR rules. During the crisis, and they mentioned, like, in a quote, media handling emphasized consistent terminology. Totally. And man, you read that six times, like that's just key, even pre-incident, of using the same words to mean the same thing within your context and your org. And then they have this structure in there they call the decision gate for public release. And they had this little, I think it was four bullets, where every time, or they also repeatedly say execution, then communication. So they're taking into account, we don't want to, you know, show our hand to the adversary here. So they're basically saying under promise and over deliver. So if we're going to restore all this stuff, then before we communicate that to the public, because their stakeholders are the public, right? So they were in a weird situation. They had to notify the public, and they said, well, let's fix the thing. And then the PR gets unembargoed. And they had these bullets that were basically like a litmus test, like, is this going to help more than hurt? And the fact that they put those guardrails in place and were able to execute on them, and by the way, I mean, even when it comes to scale of impact and all of that, it's got to be comparable to Jaguar Land Rover. And this would be a really cool comparison study to do, you know, when this level of detail comes out on JLR, it would be really, because they probably had a much worse budget at the state of Nevada, but maybe better prep, better security leadership. And I hate to crap on individuals. That's not what I'm saying whatsoever. But the output of security leadership, perhaps that was better. Maybe they were more unshackled. We'll see. All right, guys. Is it time for the Move the Needle?
Sure.
Episode 4? All right. So I'm moving along with this. This has always been fun. I just want to talk about a few more of them this episode, about like products and whether or not these things really, despite all the revenue they were able to accumulate from people like us, whether or not they actually made the world a safer place. Have we talked about RSA Secure ID and by extension YubiKeys? Like, do you guys feel like that made a difference in the world?
You mean as the one of the earlier instantiations of hardware two-factor?
Yeah.
Well, I don't think anybody who's ever implemented the RSA Secure ID found that to be easy.
What are you talking about? I loved it. I love having those big fat tokens in the old days. Come on.
Well, you got the user experience, but then you got the whole like actual system integration side of it too. I mean, if you're saying they moved the needle because they were one of the first to mass market this, Because, you know, there were hardware two-factor before then. So what is it about RSA or YubiKey that they did differently that made it more palatable?
Well, I mean, I think for RSA and time-based one-time passwords, maybe it was marketing and distribution, but they got it out there. They made it very possible for companies to get on board with it. And I mean, it was, 20 years ago that it was ubiquitous at that point. And I'd say it moved the needle. I mean, it won a ton of battles. It allowed a lot of key capture and password compromises to not matter, right? Because even back then, if you had your act together, you knew that you had to have multi-factor on anything that was internet facing. And that was the way you did multi-factor, was with those hard keys. So I think they moved the needle. I'm giving them credit on that one.
I think YubiKey did have a positive impact. It's surprising, and maybe I'm mixing technologies here, but I don't think I am. But, you know, the whole idea of enclave, and because they had an enclave, YubiKeys have enclave on their devices, and somebody mm-hmm. could be honest if I'm wrong. But mm-hmm. but that version on Windows had been around for a while, since like 2009, 2010, maybe even earlier, the TPM chip, what they call TPM chips on Windows. Mm-hmm. It didn't have that kind of an impact on the endpoints for whatever reason. So TPMs weren't used. They were used on servers last time I checked, at least on Windows early on. But it wasn't used necessarily on the laptops. It didn't have that impact until YubiKeys. I would argue YubiKeys made things mm-hmm. a lot easier to do that. And I cannot, once I rolled out YubiKeys across I started with the engineering department, they loved it. They loved it a lot more than having to do some other form of multi-factor authentication.
Yeah, so, I mean, I think so. I mean, if RSA moves the needle because of this, the marketing side of it, being able to take a known standard and get it out into the field, I think actually having trusted processing running on it and cryptography running on the actual device, I don't know that they created that technology, but again, they certainly made it mainstream. And I remember, just hearing about shops that had deployed it and stuck them in laptops, and all the developers knew you touch this button every time that you want to log in, even for like key-based authentication to unlock the key, if you will, for like SSH authentication, to just hit it. I was shocked to hear how the UX was working and how developers and engineers were actually embracing that and running with it. And that's what makes something successful.
You know, one thing though, I wish, I'm sure it's because of some patent, but it's something that you think should just be baked into every machine, right?
Totally.
Why? I think one thing that YubiKey did that was useful was to change the form factor, but it's still a form factor that you have to insert in. It would be so much nicer if we just had a form factor that was just part of the laptop.
Well, you remember forever in AD, it was smart cards. To do this, it was smart cards.
That's right.
And that sucked. It was impossible to implement.
Sure. Right. But if you think about the YubiKeys today, it's still something you have to insert. Why do you have to insert it at all? In fact, I mean, my YubiKey on my laptop, it has a form factor. We bought a whole bunch for our team. And the ones that, of course, are most popular are the ones where you don't even have to take it out, right? You just stick it in.
I used to use that. Yep. Yeah.
Right. So if you just stick it in and you're now occupying your USB port permanently or near permanently, again, why not just bake it in? Why not make it part of the hardware of the laptop itself?
Well, I can only speak about like when I was deploying this, I can only speak about Macs, right? So that's why I was trying to bring the TPM enclave technology on Windows mm-hmm. and Windows servers. But when I brought it to the laptops, I think, Sunil, and somebody please keep me honest, maybe Macs back in 2012, 2013, whenever YubiKeys came in the market, maybe Macs didn't have enclave technology. They do now. You can do things like vendors like Beyond Identity, passwordless things.
Well,
they use that enclave on the laptops, but maybe it wasn't there.
This brings up a really interesting point, right? So the new state of the art and like pass keys and web authn, they require generating, not just storing, but generating a key pair in a device that has the capability to do that, has some CPU, some cryptographic capability, and the UBs can do that. And Windows Hello can utilize a TPM to be able to do it on a Windows device. And a Mac can too. Chrome can also in cloud storage. And when you try to, we actually have a problem right now because when you log into a site that will enable passkeys, for example, if you have one, then you could supplicate it and then you can log in. But I've repeatedly now logged into sites and then had it say, you know, I'm successfully logged in. And the first thing it says is like, hey, it's not clear about this. It's very cagey. But what it's trying to say is, don't you want to create another passkey on this device?
I've created
and dumped a passkey into Google Cloud because I'm moving so fast. I'm like, what just happened? Damn it.
Yeah.
And now you've ruined everything. But with the Mac in particular, I'm pretty sure, and there are a bunch of listeners out here that are going to be like, yeah, of course you can. But I'm pretty sure you can generate one in hardware on the actual laptop. But I'll be damned if I can figure out a way to keep them from sucking it into iCloud. They want to put that in iCloud to the extent that they want to prompt you to create an iCloud account before you even can enroll a passkey. Right. And it's under the guise of portability. And that makes sense.
Recovery, Jerry. Recovery.
Yeah, you're right.
Okay, you know.
And that's, you know, kudos to the YubiKey for that because you can pull it, you can literally put it in your iPhone's USB-C port, which is so damn cool when you do it the first time. So I get that. But there is a battle going on right now for our passkeys. Everybody wants to have them because how easy is it going to be to move off of Chrome when it has all your passkeys in it?
Yeah. YubiKey in the old days used to have two different slots within that, depending on which version you bought. I think Sunil, the little guy, might had it or may not. But anyway, one slot contained the private key on it to authenticate. But there was another slot that you can use. You have in the old days, you had to use some sort of Linux stuff to make it work. But you can then put your SSH private keys. So instead of storing your SSH private keys on your laptop, you can actually store it on the YubiKey. I think it was useful? It was geeky for me, but it freaking broke things. So it wasn't that easy to do early on. But they did move the needle. Back to this whole thing, they did move the needle. Jerry, you're on mute.
Yeah, the reason I'm laughing is, and I think a lot of our listeners will too, is that when you started talking about that, I immediately thought of all of those, I was going to say Slack, but like Trillion or AOL or whatever people were chatting in back in the day. How many times did you see someone suddenly paste in a 48 character, I forget if it was hex or whatever, and it was that they hit the YubiKey and it was the top piece slot.
Oh, yes, now we got your key.
Right?
That's
and
right.
And you're
that's
like,
right.
Yeah, exactly. You never could do anything with it, but it was like micro shaming.
Well, I mean, I think on the SSH private key, my big thing was when you scan, what people were doing is instead of just keeping their SSH private key on their personal laptops, or not personal, work laptops, they would start copying it across everywhere, all these servers, because they just wanted to just tunnel through. They didn't want to go and authenticate again. And so I was like, stop that. Your private keys, it didn't have a password. It wasn't password protected. So the private keys were totally exposed out there.
It's info stealer all over again.
That's right. Exactly.
Right? Because, I mean, that's a pretty, maybe still hot, but at least it was a year ago, where someone's logged into something at work, and then they save the password in their personal Chrome profile. It syncs. They got info stealer on their home computer because they don't have these grand protections, and they pull it. The same is going to happen with the passkeys now when Chrome keeps on trying to generate them into that different enclave, into that Chrome syncs it over to your home account.
AWS secret keys and access keys.
Yeah.
Uploaded to GitHub by intentionally or by mistake.
Right. Right. All right. So, moving on from that. There's another little headline on here, too, that about someone stealing and selling cyber exploits to Russia.
It does beg a couple interesting questions, which is, you know, we have the cyber exploit marketplace that operates largely in the shadows for good reason, right? And as purveyors of cyber exploits, if there are opportunities to sell the exact same good to multiple people, you would see people taking advantage of that, right? Because in theory, if you're doing this the proper way, under the proper safeguards and whatnot, you would sell to one particular entity, and they would not release it out to the wild. They would have a very targeted operation. And then you could sell that exact same exploit to somebody else, and no one would be the wiser that it's being sold twice. Now, of course, they do sell it multiple times. And so I think that's part of the nature of this market itself. And so now if you take one of these exploits and sell it to Russia, and I'm not sure exactly, it wasn't clear who in Russia, if it was the GRU or if it was, you know, a state actor or a non-state actor or whatnot. But if it were a state actor, in some respects, it's sort of like, well, the concern, of course, is one concern is would they use it against U.S. targets, right? But this is actually now where we get to an earlier part of the conversation we had at the very beginning about threat intelligence. And could, I don't know if I know what the answer to this is, but if there is entities like L3, Harris, who have been sanctioned the ability to sell cyber weapons, not necessarily to the Russians, but just anybody, right? Should our national security apparatus have insights into how to look for these when they're being pointed back at us?
Oh, like a backdoor to the backdoor?
Not a backdoor. It doesn't have to even be the specific exploit, but maybe an indication that an exploit, some sort of indication that an exploit has been redirected towards us.
Perhaps. Public sector problems.
So, you know, the thing that I mean, it was surprising to me was like, wow, America is in a bad place when Russia can pay for this stuff and we can't pay for the FAA. So we're like, wow, we have really hit rock bottom, folks.
Speaking of the gray market, so to speak, there's another headline here that it really sucks. Like, I think it's kind of a sad thing. It was a couple of folks that worked for a completely legit U.S. firm that really specialized in negotiating ransoms during cyber attacks went rogue. And the FBI is onto them. And as part of the claims here, they apparently started extorting companies with ransomware themselves, these previous white hats. And I mean, there's a ton of awful things about that, of course. But what I really hated was like going back to the beginning here and the FUD machine, right? Now I feel like it's only a matter of time. There's some startup right now who's specializing in figuring out if people are going rogue from security companies, I bet. And there, once they get their funding, they're going to use that to have all these articles about how all companies need to figure out that their vendors don't have people going rogue, right? It's going to turn into this big machine. It's like, isolate a case, just two people, but I really fear it's going to reflect poorly on the environment and make a lot of people have to jump through hoops to prove. Yeah.
Palantir do this already? What are you talking about? There's already a company making a ton of money on this stuff.
Oh, well, yeah, actually, yeah, you might be right. Well, then they're going to love this one, but... Yeah, I mean, you know, people from the security industry going rogue, that is not going to do any favors for the whole industry at all. So I hope people will see this as an isolated incident and not overreact. We shall see. Yeah. All right. Next article that we want to talk about here, contributing editor article about cybersecurity is a digital identity problem. Do you guys feel that that's true? I mean, I don't know. I can't even understand how people manage to turn identity into this huge boondoggle that it seems to be.
Well, hold on. I'm not sure if I understand why you think it's not an identity problem. I think one can say at its core, it starts with that. And many of our failures are because we don't have a strongly authenticated, strongly bounded identity.
I mean, there was a point where I used to think like if you look at like a bear with me here. Okay, I'm going to get crazy, but like a TCP header, right? IP headers, TCP headers, and you can sign, you can have signature information in there, right? I think that's how IPsec works. So I used to think every packet on the internet should be signed by someone who's responsible for it. And if that's involved malicious activity, then you're the one who's going to have to answer for that. Right. And similar to not allowing paying for ransomware, the idea is that it'd be like, whoa. Of course I signed that. I mean, I automatically sign everything that comes out of my MacBook, and someone else was on it and they broke in. It's not my fault. And say, well, yeah, I'm sorry, but you know the rule. And then people would start, oh, crap, I really care about security. I don't want to have my MacBook pop. Mm. So to that extent, yeah, that'd be great. Privacy's gone.
Right.
Right. Privacy is at complete odds with this. So, I don't know. I mean, is that just explicitly assumed in here when you say cybersecurity is a digital identity problem? Is it also saying privacy is the enemy?
It's a trade-off at the end of the day. It's one of the challenges that we have in the whole debate about security and privacy, because you can't necessarily make an argument that is entirely one-sided. And we saw this with the San Bernardino case, where Apple chose to take the privacy route, and the FBI wanted the security route, right? At the end of the day, I think it's the tech companies want to shed their responsibility altogether by saying, look, we don't even have the ability to decrypt. So there you go, right? So anyway, the point is, I think at the end of the day, there is a, you can still have an identity. The identity may not necessarily be associatable with an actual person. The cryptocurrency ecosystem. But nonetheless, everything, if at the very core of everything, there is some strongly bounded identity, then yeah, at some level, privacy is no longer available. And that may be disclosable through subpoenas and through whatever, but at some level, the stronger your identity binding, the better your cybersecurity overall.
Well, I mean, so this headline starts with cybersecurity. Cybersecurity is a digital identity problem. So what is cybersecurity? Like, why do people care about it? Why are people listening to podcasts and all of that? For better or worse, ransomware is more than 50% of the motivation of people to care about cybersecurity. Like, I mean, that's what really hits people hard day in, day out, directly or indirectly. And it's really driving the industry. And we have all these knock-on things that we care about as a result. But like, that's the headline generator and the attention getter. What the hell does digital identity have to do with that?
Well, okay, let's start with the entry point for ransomware. How does someone get ransomware? They log into some page that purports to have an identity that it doesn't have.
Yeah. I'm going to be a very reptilian, my reptilian brain here, so please forgive me. I'm just going to say, to me, this just goes back to the basic of username and password. So when I thought about this digital identity, I didn't go as deep as you guys went, okay? And the article talks about FIDO Alliance. Awesome. Love it. FIDO 2. Love it. And passkeys, everything, etc. We have been using a world, my amphibian brain, it went back to the, a username and passwords and how ineffective they are, because they really are easy to move around, to be easily compromised. And we see that over and over and over. Most security breaches today that have had the biggest major data breaches in history all go back to some sort of username and password.
That's why I use the ransomware example, though. Like Sunil's was saying, I mean, he's right. Let's use the Nevada thing. Someone clicked on something and he was saying, well, identity still applies, because he thought he was getting the real NT resource kit and instead he was getting some bogus one. But and then this article goes on to talk about FIDO and passkeys, and like, they're not thinking about that. They're thinking about the end user. So, I think
I took it to be the end user, Jerry. I took it to be the end user, quite honestly.
Yeah. I mean, if you're talking about like the thing, the market, if you will, that goes down to like, oh, you got somebody to go work on your kitchen renovation and you thought it was a big company. Really, it wasn't, because they kind of overspoke. But as long as they did a good job, who would really care? Like when this guy went out to the NT, get the NT resource kit, how much of a picture did he have of what the identity was of the authorized supplier of that? And, you know, the best we've ever done is the lock icon is there. It really is stupid fake Microsoft things dot top. You know, the identity was good. I mean, how much better could it get?
Well, but the problem is that it's still an identity problem. And if we can make that better in some way, then we solve a much bigger issue. And this is also pertinent. I mean, think about it with phishing. What is phishing but an identity problem, right? We don't have strongly bounded identities to the entities that send out that email. And if there is there needs to be a more collective action type of approach to solving that problem, because right now the approach that we're taking isn't really working. But fundamentally, phishing is an identity problem.
Yeah. No, I can see that. All right.
One thing I think is I'm somewhat hopeful for, though, is that deep fakes is also an identity problem.
Right.
And while people may not have the wherewithal to say, to have the collective action to solve the phishing problem, I think society as a whole will have the wherewithal to address the deep fake problem. Okay. And what is deep fakes? But yet another identity problem of digital content. What is email? Just a very small version of that digital content. Mm. So I hope that at some level, the opportunity for us to find ways to fix or solve the problem of deep fakes through better identity mechanisms and verification mechanisms will also serve as a base, as a foundation to be able to solve messaging as well.
Just for the record, Sunil and Jerry, that wasn't me flying that jet plane and pooping on people. So just for the record, right?
Well, I was going to say, if the Postal Service is any indicator of whether or not we're going to solve this problem, I don't think we're going to solve it anytime soon, right? I mean, we talk about identity, like the garbage that comes in the mail all day that we all tolerate and are totally happy with and that funds the United States Postal Service is here to stay. And and how about phone calls and everything in between?
Yeah. Well, again, and those, you know, all those are identity problems, though. The part of the question that we originally had a long time ago with the NSTIC, if those who might remember it, I forget the acronym, something about identity, was who would be the prover,
the arbiter of justice.
Yeah, and the Postal Service was actually a consideration, right? And the reason why was because almost universally, regardless of what country you're in, you have some postal service mechanism to deliver mail, even if you don't really have a, somehow mail gets to you.
Yeah.
And so that was an interesting argument. The other argument was to use banks. Banks, have a KYC requirement as well, but not everyone is banked, and that became an issue too.
But I mean, even in mail, like physical mail is starting to look a lot like my email. Most of the correspondence I'm getting from like my banks are actually online. I get my, my investments, you get it online. I hardly get anything anymore delivered on mail, physical mail. What I get is just basically a version of spam. I just get a bunch of junk in my email. You know what I mean? It just looks like my email now.
That's right. Well, it's been fun. Till next time. But, last time we mentioned people using the LinkedIn page for the Adversarial Podcast for any comments or questions. Please continue to do that. And in particular, if you got anything for the Did You Move the Needle, it might be on our forthcoming list anyway, but let us know and we'll move it up. But thanks, guys.
Cheers.
Bye-bye.